Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg. I'm going to be one of your hosts for today's show. I'm here together with Gina McAndrews.
Hello, Ursula.
And
hello,
Gina.
To all of our listeners. We have an exciting show today.
Lots of water out there today, Gina. We're going to be talking about water and land, and we have three experts here to speak with us today. Mark Rasmussen at the Leopold Center, Dan Haug, who is with the Prairie Rivers of Iowa, and Ava Aaron Ryan, who is with Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, ICCI, and she'll be discussing a lawsuit that they are bringing forth about water quality.
We're going to start off with Mark Rasmussen, director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture here in Iowa. Welcome, Mark. I know our listeners are curious to know just what you've been doing over at the Leopold Center and your projects and research that you've been continuing to work on.
Mark, when we mentioned to a number of people that you would be coming on to the radio show, questions were raised as to whether Leopold Center is even still around after it was defunded by the Iowa legislature. So are you still around, and is the Leopold Center still functioning?
We're still around, and we're still kicking. We make do best we can with what resources we have left. And we seem to be busy as ever because it's just Fred Kirschman and I. And so we do everything with regards to the center, from answering emails, answering the phone, to running the vacuum cleaner now and then when we need to.
Can you remind folks a little bit about what the Leopold Center is and kind of where it came from?
Yeah, the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture was originally created in 1987 by the state legislature. And its mission was to identify aspects of agriculture that are a problem with regards to the environment, including, you know, not just natural resources, but also the social environment of rural America or rural Iowa, and to look for solutions to those problems. And so we had, for many years, had this fee from nitrogen fertilization that from the sale of nitrogen fertilizer that came to us, and the center used that to fund all kinds of research over 30-some years. And that was the fund that was switched over to the Nutrient Research Center here this last year and a half ago. And so they're essentially doing the same thing, although the mission of that center is more narrow to nitrogen, phosphorus, nutrient management, whereas the Leopold Center was much broader in terms of its mission. I like to always say that it had, you know, the term everything to do with food, farming, and agriculture was its mission. We still have some foundation money, which is what we continue to work with, and we still support speakers coming to campus. We still support meetings. For example, coming up in June, June 21st and 22nd at Central College in Pella, there's the local foods group that was spun off from the Leopold Center is having a farm-to-school conference with regards to food and local food production and so forth. And so we're supporters of that meeting. So that's an example of where we still put our funding to help put on meetings.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that farm-to-school conference? I mean, what are some of the projects they're doing?
Well, I can talk a little bit more broadly about the local foods effort. I haven't been involved in planning on that particular meeting, but Craig Chase is he's the head of the local foods group. And for many years, they were part of the Leopold Center, and then a couple of years ago, we decided to spin them off as an independent because they were growing and they were getting a lot of funding for local food efforts around the state. And it's kind of an interesting phenomenon because not only do they have to work to generate producers that produce local food in the state, but you also have to create the markets for it, not just farmers markets that occur in the summer, but also they've worked with companies that for employees maybe to purchase on their way home from after they get off work, but also grocery stores to have local food areas in their store. And that's been quite successful. There's a high degree of interest around the state, especially they really initially worked very well in eastern Iowa and northeastern Iowa, especially where they really got going. And it's expanded now across the state to various degrees. And then, of course, you get like the Des Moines Farmers Market is almost world renowned now in terms of its size and, expanse. Mm-hmm. So.
And I know the Leopold Center used to fund a lot of graduate students for their research and a lot of different research projects. Are you still able to do any of that?
Yes, the GPSA, as we call it, the Graduate Program in Sustainable Agriculture, we still contribute money to that. That's part of the endowment funds that we still have. We contribute we have an MOU with that interdepartmental group. And we hope to continue to do that on into the future with the funds we have. So, and those students do all kinds of work, from soil erosion to cropping rotations, and mm-hmm. It's really interesting to see the breadth of work that they do at the university.
And so I think you have some events coming up you wanted to mention.
Well, I did want to mention some other work that Fred Kirschman does. He, as you may know, is half time. He serves half time with Stone Barns in New York, and that's a food and agriculture center in Westchester County. It's affiliated with the Rockefeller family. It was originally Rockefeller property. And so he spends a week, a month approximately out there as president of their board. And so it's a whole different emphasis because they're focused on very urban people who are interested in agriculture. And they have a different background or a different perspective on farming than we do here in the Midwest, where we're surrounded by it. Recently they've been given some more land after David Rockefeller passed away, and so they want to get more into grass-fed beef raising, and I'm in communications with them to come out and talk and consult with them on that. And, of course, Fred, he's very knowledgeable about beef production, too, coming from his North Dakota ranch where mm-hmm. he has produced cattle for many years. And secondly, Fred is our representative on the White Rock Conservancy Board. We are a supporting organization, I think is the term they use for in their bylaws. And so he goes to all the board meetings and keeps me in touch with what's the goings on at White Rock.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would point out is that a particular research project, and I guess this is kind of relevant to all this wet weather we're having, is that I'm with a group at Iowa State, and we're looking at soil carbon as a sequestration means for CO2 and climate change. And people are probably very familiar with the role that carbon dioxide plays in being a heat blanket in the atmosphere. Some is good, but too much is not so good. And some of this weird weather is probably the result of our climate changing. And we're not the only ones, but there's a group of us at Iowa State that are looking at how can we sequester more carbon in the soil, mm-hmm. and not just organic carbon that comes from decaying roots and plant material, but also my particular branch of it is carbonate, which is limestone.
Okay.
And that's also a form of carbon. In fact, that's the largest carbon reservoir on the planet when you look at all this geologic formation of, the White Cliffs of Dover, things like uh-huh. that. That's all carbonate. And just here in North Ames, we have a limestone mine.
Right.
And there are hundreds of trucks go in and out of there on a weekly basis, hauling away old geologic carbonate, limestone, for various construction projects. But limestone also occurs in smaller pieces in the soil. And so we're trying to understand the biological processes that seem to be involved with the production of that carbonate. And is this a way that we can put carbon away just as we can with other biological forms of carbon and, you know, help reduce the amount that's accumulating in the atmosphere?
So, Mark, does the limestone itself play any role, or is that more just a visual aid, in a sense, to understand how carbonate works? But do you actually use the limestone for anything in terms of capturing carbon?
Well, you possibly could. I mean, right now, if we're just depositing it in the soil, mm-hmm. you know, and farmers oftentimes, especially from here in east, in the eastern part of the Corn Belt, in order to adjust the pH of their soil, they have to put down very powdered limestone every once in a while to raise the pH of their soil. Now, you go to western Iowa and eastern Nebraska, and this is where I'm interested, having come from there, is there you can actually find nodules of carbonate in the soil that may be the size of your thumb or something. And we're trying to, and this is in one wind-blown lush soils. So we know these nodules didn't blow in there. They've developed since the soil has been deposited. And so we're trying to understand if it's microbes associated with plant roots that are involved. And these are called rhizoliths in the geologic literature. And just how are these nodules formed? And how much is in the soil and how much could be stored in the soil? Because carbon in the form of limestone is a pretty stable, you know, there's people talking about putting liquefied CO2 underground, but, you know, that all depends on the capstone holding it in there and it doesn't leak back out. Well, limestone is pretty stable unless you dump acid on it. It'll, of course, evolve. If you pour mm-hmm. acid on a piece of limestone, it'll fizz and buzz, and it'll release CO2 back into the atmosphere. But
so this is kind of a layperson's question. I'm imagining, and I don't know if I'm correct in this, that the carbon is in the air, or the CO2 is in the air.
The CO2 is in the air,
and,
yes.
And so, and then you've got somehow it becomes limestone in the ground, and I'm trying to picture how it gets from the air into a piece of rock.
There's a term that people, it's in the literature, in the scientific literature, called microbial carbonate precipitation. And we think that microbes actually are involved in forming, taking that CO2 and forming it into a solid form.
And a microbe is what?
Well, a bacteria, uh-huh. you know, some little bug that lives in the soil.
Huh.
But, you know, there's all kinds of marine organisms, too, that produce shells and other forms in the ocean that are also carbonate.
And they use CO2 from the air to do that.
Well, there's an intermediate. I mean, it dissolves in water, it becomes bicarbonate, mm-hmm. and then they take that up and make an oyster shell, for example.
And then they sequester it by turning it into something like a shell.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But actually, as the pH of the ocean is changing, of ocean water is changing, it's getting harder for those organisms to produce or to make carbonate to form into their shell. And pearls,
and
for example.
Why is it getting?
Well, because, again, as you add CO2 to water, it acidifies it a little bit as carbonic acid. And so the pH of ocean, which is above neutrality, is slowly coming down because the ocean is soaking up most of the excess CO2 right now.
Uh-huh.
I forget, it's something like 80%. So it's been a very large sink of the extra CO2 that's been emitted since we've been burning fossil fuels.
Hmm.
But there is great concern over, you know, even if you stop the heating phenomena in the atmosphere, you still have this pH lowering phenomena in ocean water, mm-hmm. and how that may interfere with these different organisms. And coral is another example of carbonate that's formed by biological processes.
And pearls?
Yeah, pearls.
They're not making pearls anymore?
No. They're a lot of pearls are farmed now.
Okay.
And those are under more controlled conditions where they can take care of the, uh-huh. you know, the pH of the water. So
so as more carbon is into the oceans, how does that then affect the oxygen? availability?
Well, oxygen is, you know, very abundant at 20-some percent. But it is interesting that not only have we seen an increase of CO2 with burning of fossil fuels, you do see a very minor decrease in oxygen, because that's the, you know, that's part of the equation,
the balance,
too,
yeah,
of utilizing that fossil fuel that requires oxygen. But we have plenty of oxygen around.
And so specifically, what is your research looking at? Microbial activity?
Well, is to try and understand the processes by which the soil and the life in the soil are forming these nodules. And so I'm working with a faculty member in geology. The first step, we had an honors student this last semester who was simply looking and carbon dating and doing some other analytical procedures on how old are these nodules and what are they made of initially. And they are what we thought they were, primarily calcium carbonate. So,
and so will that then be a challenge to monitor the pH of the soil if we have
You know, obviously there are limits to how much carbonate you could put away in the soil. And the other people involved who are working with organic carbon in the soil, you know, we have a lot of organic matter in our soils here in central Iowa because they're very dark and fertile and rich. But you get in southern Iowa, you get in western Iowa, the soils are paler in color. They could certainly stand to have a lot more organic matter in them. And so people are looking at various, you know, cover crops, for example, legume cultivation, alfalfa, those sorts of things. What can we do with farming practices to actually put more organic matter back in the soil? Because for 100 or so years in our farming procedures, we've actually been depleting the organic matter. Soils that used to have around 8% maybe have 4% now. Because when you plow and till and mix oxygen with the soil, then that stimulates the microbes to actually break down that organic matter. And so that's one of the benefits of no-till farming also, is when you don't stir that soil and put a lot of oxygen into that soil profile.
And so, for people out there, what's the importance of organic matter in our soil? Why should we worry about that?
Oh, well, it's very relevant to our wet spring. I mean, organic matter helps hold nutrients so they don't go into the field tiles and down the stream, but it also helps hold water. There are farmers who have been doing some of these practices for 20, 30 years, and their soils are really quite amazing in the amount of water that they will hold. You can just think of that soil with a lot of organic matter as being kind of like a giant sponge for these nutrients like nitrate that are mobile, but also for the water that it falls on the land. And that makes for a very dynamic reservoir of nutrients and water when you get later in the summer when it doesn't rain. And organic matter is very important for a good fertile soil.
So on some of these hilly areas, say like in southern Iowa where they're doing a lot of row cropping, what might be some better options to keep more?
Well, and that gets to my second theme, is we need to get that a lot of that land back into perennials and forage production rather than corn, soybean. A few years ago when corn was $7 a bushel, you know, we plowed up a lot of land. We tore out a lot of trees in order to put in row crop. And that's okay for a while, but it needs to get back. And the big issue is, how do you make an income off of that land if you're going to put it back in perennials? And ruminants are a big converter of that. And they can utilize all kinds of feedstuffs, pasture, brome grass, alfalfa hay, different things. And then, of course, you sell the animal, cattle or sheep, and that's what you generate your income from.
Mm-hmm. What exactly is a ruminant?
Well, ruminants are they're a group of herbivores that have a specialized anatomy in their GI tract. If you and I tried to eat a bale of straw, we wouldn't do very well. But yet, ruminants can do so. And they have an organ, a large fermentation organ in their GI tract called the rumen. And it contains all kinds of microbes that can break down that cellulose, that fiber that's in hay and grass and so on. And then that, in turn, feeds the cow. So the microbes, the bacteria and protozoa and so forth consume that fiber, and then they feed the animal. And so they're much more versatile than a pig or a chicken in terms of the kinds of feeds. And I like to comment, especially during all this rainy weather, when everybody's machinery is sitting there waiting for the fields to dry out, that a cow as a harvesting unit can work in the rain as long as it's not too muddy and you churn up the soil with their hooves and so forth.
Cattle are ruminants?
Yes, cattle are ruminants,
sheep.
Goats.
Yep, goats.
Horses.
No, not horses. Horses are hindgut fermenters, like elephants and rhinos. That's a different...
No rhinos. Giraffes, but no rhinos.
Yeah. Think of a lot of the wildlife on the Serengeti Plains, other than zebra and those kind of horse-type animals are different. They have a fermentation chamber further down in the GI tract, but it means for a whole different, because of that difference, they have a whole different digestive strategy than ruminants do.
Mm-hmm. So originally, I guess it would have been buffalo.
Yes, bison are ruminants.
Uh-huh, bison. Yes. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we're speaking with Mark Rasmussen, who's the director of the Leopold Center. Thank you, Mark, for spending time to educating us. We're going to take a short music break and then come back and talk more about land, water, and agriculture.
If there's a hole in your soul, you gotta fill it. If your cup is overflowing, don't spill it. You better hold it while the whole world's spinning around. And when your eyes look down on another, just remember that he's your own brother. This kind of love ain't gonna go under. I found that when you love one another, only good rain comes down. And if you feel like you stop learning, if the wood in your fire ain't burning, better spark another match, start turning your wheel. Better turn towards righteous living, stop taking and start your giving. Yeah, this is the one thing missing, I fear. That loving one another is the only thing real. Don't let your blessings turn into stone. That kind of living will leave you all alone. If there's a hole in your soul, you gotta fill it. And if your cup is overflowing, don't spill it. You better hold it while the whole world's spinning around. Spark healing. Yeah, the first step is when you start believing it's real. Yeah, this is the one thing missing, I feel. Yeah. That loving one another is the only thing real.
Yeah. Good Rain by Trevor Hall. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts today, here with Gina McAndrews.
Yes, we've been talking with Mark Rasmussen, who's the director of the Leopold Center. And he's been telling us a little bit about some different ways to think about soil and water and the projects they're still working on and hoping to continue to do in the future to help get more carbon out of the air and into the soil. We also are lucky enough to have Daniel Haug with us, who is the designated as the watershed educator for the Prairie Rivers of Iowa. Hello, Dan. How are you doing?
Doing good.
Good. Thank you for coming in today. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the Prairie Rivers and what your projects are?
Yeah. Prairie Rivers of Iowa is a nonprofit based in Ames, and we're a little unusual in the landscape of Iowa nonprofits in that we have both natural resources and cultural resources, economic development as part of our mission. So we're grant-driven, so over the years those projects have changed as our partners have identified new needs. So that's taken the form of building log cabins in Hamilton County at Little Wall Lake, of school community gardens, outdoor learning environments, urban forestry. And our current projects now are managing the Lincoln Heritage Byway and working with the communities along that historic road to promote tourism and their historic resources, and then our watershed program. So we've been working for, I think, over 4 years with the Squaw Creek Watershed and that management authority and helping create that plan and helping work with farmers and communities in that watershed to improve our water quality.
And so what are some of the projects you're doing to help improve that water quality?
Well, right now we just got a 3-year grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation that will allow us to focus on the kind of the overlap between practices that benefit wildlife and pollinators and those that improve water quality. So this will be working with landowners in three watersheds, the Whirly Creek and Clear Creek area west of Ames, then West Indian Creek near Nevada, and then Long Dick Creek near Story City.
And as an educator, what is your role in this big project?
We can't get farmers and landowners to put practices on the landscape until they understand what it means and the benefits of that. So education is a real big part of everything we do. And we work with all ages. So, you know, we'll be working with landowners, have a field day coming up June 26, focused on wetlands in Camerar. We've been working with volunteers lately, helping the Squaw Creek Watershed Coalition organize a water quality monitoring snapshot. So getting people in the water is a great way to, you know, spark that curiosity. And then I work with schools. So I visited fourth graders at United Elementary this spring, talking about conservation practices and kind of problem solving about conservation. And right now I've been working with four high school biology students testing out some equipment for sampling runoff in our neighborhoods and getting a sense for how that contributes to water quality.
Wow, you're really keeping busy.
Yeah.
If people were interested in coming to your seminar in Camerar, where would they find out more information about that?
I think we will have some information on our website, prrcd.org. coming up. But that field day is going to be June 26 in the evening, 5 to 7 p.m., and it is at Camerar Wildlife Area.
And can you tell us a little more about the water snapshot and how, if people are interested, how they might get involved with that too?
Yeah, so this was May 18. We had 16 people come out and gave them a little training on how to do some different water tests and then sent them around to Squaw Creek and its tributaries and get an idea, you know, it gives you a snapshot, a point in time of our water quality and a bunch of different streams. So I think we'll have another one of those in October, you know, due to each year. And then hopefully this summer I'm going to be trying to get people learning about what lives in our creek and do some, you know, sampling some of the bugs and the mussels and things that live in our rivers. So
what are you finding out as far as water quality in our area? The levels of nutrients and that sort of thing.
Yes, so we see pretty high levels of nitrate and phosphorus, the nutrients, the fertilizers, and that especially happens when we have bare soils and the crops aren't taking that up. So you know that connects to this wet spring we've been having, and certainly, whenever you have a heavy rain like we.
We've had a couple of those.
Yep, that can wash a lot of soil, and we've seen a few times when Clear Creek was no longer running clear, it was running chocolate, and there's there's a lot of tools out there to get a sense of water quality. One of the fun ones I like to look at is the Daily Erosion Project that's been developed by Iowa State and Rick Cruz. And so you can see, you know, estimate how many tons of soil have been lost on a particular day. And so, like, I looked at this last year, and so, you know, for the calendar year to date, like, pretty much all of the soil loss happened on one day, May 24. And we could see that. One of my friends went out and collected some samples, and, you know, you were the water clarity had gone down from being able to see through the whole 60-centimeter tube to now you couldn't see the pattern until you got down to 1 centimeter. So you can really see that difference. But weather makes a big difference in when sediment is moving. So
what are you teaching us, some of the ways that people can reduce that sediment runoff and water and nutrient runoff? Because that probably has contributed through our urban areas as well as just our farm fields.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And and I think one of the things has already come up, this idea of soil as sponges, that if you improve the organic matter in the soil, that allows it to soak up more water. If you have more earthworm burrows, more roots, and that's something that farmers can do by practicing no-till or by installing cover crops to improve the organic matter in the soil. It's also something that homeowners can do. And City of Ames actually offers a rebate for people to aerate their lawn and apply a compost. And so, you know, that's something that any homeowner can do, or building a rain garden to slow down and let some of the water coming off your roof soak into the ground. So, and of course, anything you can do to reduce the amount of runoff reduces the potential for that to wash soil or nutrients into our waterways.
Right. That sounds like a lot of great projects, and kind of interacts a little bit with some of our southern Iowa areas where we could maybe put a little more of that into grass. And can you explain a little bit more maybe on how that might keep more carbon in the soil if we had more grass and cattle down there instead of corn and soybeans?
Yeah, this is Mark again. When you have perennials like that, of course, the roots stabilize the soil. You're not tilling it, so you're not destroying that from year to year, and those plants continue to grow, and they can grow deeper root systems. And then, of course, with the cattle grazing on that land, they're returning the manure right on the spot, as opposed to in a feedlot or in a confined situation where then you'd have to haul it back onto the land. And the whole spectrum of life that's in a perennial crop like that, as Dan was saying, the worms, the earthworms, the beetles, the dung beetles that actually help distribute that manure, they continue from year to year. And so you just have a gradual building of the organic matter when you have perennials like that and a grazing-type system.
And I think you have another project that sounds kind of exciting.
I think Mark has been involved with that.
Yeah, Iowa Learning Farms in Water Rocks. It's a group of people at the university. The Leopold Center have financially supported that program for several years. Jackie Comito is the director. And Water Rocks is essentially a youth education program. They go out to schools during the year, and they talk about water, they talk about soil, they talk about natural resources, and they have a very talented group of people who can interact with young people very well. I'm kind of stiff at that sort of thing with youngsters, but they have people, they can go out there and they can do songs, they can do games, they can do it in a way that interests the kids, and it's a very dynamic learning situation. And every year they're overbooked with regards to schools. They put out calls for, you know, who would like to schedule a session where we come to your school. And they can't meet the demand with the resources and the staff that they have. They have more inquiries than they can, you know, than more days in the calendar, essentially.
Right.
So they're on the road a lot, running around the state doing these programs during the school year.
What are some of the projects you do in the schools, Dan? You said you had some of your education events were at schools.
Yeah, I've worked with teachers before to get kids out in the creek and seeing what kinds of invertebrates we have living in those creeks. I've worked with some students at United to elementary school students to talk about kind of problem solving and get them thinking about solutions to water quality. And we'll have more of those coming up in the fall. So, you know, really just kind of looking all ages.
So if there were some listeners out there who are working at the schools and they'd like to get a hold of you to do some of these.
Yeah, absolutely. If we can talk about soil health, we can talk about water quality, we can help you get out in the stream. We've been working on quite a bit with our volunteer groups as well as with Story County Conservation, trying to figure out how we can support volunteer water quality monitoring going forward as DNR has kind of stepped back from their role there. So,
and how would they get a hold of you to do that?
They can check out our website, prrcd.org.
And is there a phone number they could call?
Yes, 232-0048.
And that's 515?
Yes, 515-232-0048. Prairie Rivers of Iowa.
Oh, that's great. And you also have some other seminars coming up over the summer?
Yeah, so I was mentioning we'll have a field day coming up June 26th, 5 to 7. Camera Wildlife Area, you know, one of the things we're finding, one of my coworkers, Mike Brandrup, works a lot with small landowners, with small farmers and acreage owners, you know, and we're finding that with the wet fall we had last fall, with the wet spring we've been having, there's a lot of acres in central Iowa that, you know, are not profitable in a wet year that, you know, even with the tile systems are regularly flooded out. And so landowners are wondering, okay, what do I do with that? How do I make a return on that? And so one of the options we're looking at is wetland easements. So if they aren't able to, CRP program, conservation reserve program has been, some of the caps on those have been reduced. So another option is putting a wetland easement on those. And then there are, county conservation or the Iowa Agricultural Mitigation Bank, often there are other groups out there who are looking for wetlands and can may be able to purchase that easement or buy the residual value of that land. So that can be an option to, get a return for some of those wetter spots and maybe help keep the farmer afloat during these kind of tough economic times. So that's kind of what was done at the Camera Wildlife Area, a combination of a wetland easement and a sale of the residual value. So we'll be talking about that.
So how would that work? So say I have 100 acres and I got a wet area of 1 acre and it's a $10,000 an acre field or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, just like any other kind of an easement, you know, property is like a bundle of sticks, and so you're selling off the right to farm that wet spot in the field or to have it developed, but you still can maintain your ability to hunt and fish on that property to get some other return from that land, and then eventually, if you want to sell off those remaining rights, then there may be other buyers out there. So it's kind of taking apart some of the different things that you can do with that land. So
if I keep it in a wetland, then there's a little bit of income every year, or is it kind of a one-time thing?
This would be a one-time thing, and sometimes there's a combination of, CRP and an easement. But in this case, if we're more and more we're finding it's more limitations on the CRP program, then this is a way to get at least a one-time return on that land. Yeah.
That sounds terrific. What are some other things the Prairie Rivers of Iowa are doing on around central Iowa here?
Well, as I mentioned, we help maintain the Lincoln Highway Heritage Byway. So my colleague Jane Gammon has been working a lot with the communities along that byway.
Like doing plantings or historical markers? Or?
Yeah, a lot of times historical interpretive panels.
Okay.
She's been working on with TAMA on a bridge, historic bridge restoration project. And so there's, and then promoting tourism and
promoting tourism.
Yeah, along that byway. So, and just kind of getting started to working with the folks along the Jefferson Byway that goes north-south. So,
and then what are some other folks doing in your – because, like, Mike, isn't he working in forestry as well?
He formerly had been working on our log products, helping Hamilton County Conservation develop those beautiful white oak log cabins that you'll see at Briggs Woods Lake and at Little Wall Lake. And so now he's working on our watersheds team. So he's been working with small farmers and acreage owners in the Squaw Creek watershed. Definitely if you're, if you live in the Squaw Creek watershed or really anywhere near Ames and you're wondering about what conservation opportunities there are on your property, definitely talk to Mike and he can help you figure out what some of the options are.
And is there a charge for that?
Nope, that is no cost.
Well, that sounds terrific. Well, thank you so much for coming in today. We've had Dan Haug with Prairie Rivers of Iowa and Mark Rasmussen with the Leopold Center. Thank goodness you guys are out there doing a lot of important work, especially in our rainy seasons when we need more soil to stay in place and our clean water. And I think we have some music coming up Ursula's going to play. Back at KHOI, we just finished talking with Daniel Haug with the Prairie Rivers of Iowa and Mark Rasmussen with the Leopold Center, talking about our watershed. Ava Auenroan, a staff member with the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, ICCI, is here to tell us a little bit about their second lawsuit that's attempting to force Iowa farmers in the Raccoon River watershed to reduce pollution and runoff in our water. Hello, Ava. Thank you for being with us today.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Iowa Citizens Community Improvement and also about your lawsuit?
Yeah, so I work on the Farm and Environment team at Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, and we work to stop corporate-backed factory farms and to clean up Iowa's water because we believe in a food and farm system that works for farmers, workers, eaters, and the environment. So in March, we filed a lawsuit against the state of Iowa in the fight for clean water. And like you said, the goal is to reduce pollution from factory farms and industrial agriculture. And it's based on the public trust doctrine, which is an old law that says the state has an obligation to protect our water for recreational use, and that Iowans have a right to clean water. So we're alleging that the state has failed to do their job to keep our water clean.
Okay. And is that similar to or different than the Des Moines Water Works lawsuit?
So there are going to be some similarities, but we wanted to learn from the Des Moines Water Works lawsuit. So there are a couple of key differences. You know, we are suing the state of Iowa, whereas they were suing specific counties and drainage ditches. And then it's also what we're asking for is different. I believe they're asking for monetary remedies, and our remedies would be a mandatory nutrient reduction strategy for farmers, so implementing practices that would prevent runoff and prevent water pollution, and then also a moratorium on all new or expanding factory farms within the Raccoon River watershed.
And what are some of these practices that you're promoting as far as farmers should adapt?
Sure. So they're already listed in, like, the voluntary nutrient reduction strategy. So it would be things like cover crops and buffer strips and the like. And what we're asking for is to take that same strategy and make it mandatory, because right now participation is so low that it's not making any difference in cleaning up our water. And so nutrient pollution is still staying the same.
Do you know if they have any statistics on who's been voluntarily involved in nutrient reduction or any number of acres or anything?
Yeah, that's a great question. So actually, just within the last month or two, the state released a progress report, an update on the voluntary nutrient reduction strategy. And I believe it said that less than 3% or around 3% of farmers were doing the practices. So that's why we think it's very important for it to be a mandatory strategy so it'll actually make a difference in water quality.
Well, thank you for our work. What kind of problems are you finding in the water? Is it more manure or soil?
Right. So I think that we definitely hear from members across the state who see manure spills or application near water that's running off. And those are things that we ask, you know, Iowa CCI members or other folks to send in to us and be watchdogs for. And then also with this lawsuit, we've talked to a lot of people across the state who are just too concerned about the water to be able to recreate in it, right? So whether it be like this summer going to beaches, having beach closures because of high level of nitrates, or just not being sure what's in the water. And what the lawsuit says is that Iowans have a right to know that their water is clean and that they can use it for both recreational and drinking water purposes.
And so what's the status of the lawsuit now? When will it be going to court or...
Right. So we're going to have our first hearing on June 19th. The Attorney General's office has filed to dismiss our lawsuit, but we're confident that the courts will see the merits of our case on June 19th, and we're excited to pass this first legal hurdle. And we are asking folks who are interested to join us on June 19th at the Polk County Courthouse for the hearing. It starts at 8:30 in the morning. So it'll be an early morning, but we really want to show that Iowans are vested in the quality of our water.
So that'll be at the Polk County Courthouse at 8:30 in the morning on June 19th.
That's correct.
And what happens at a hearing like that? What actually will transpire at that time?
Yeah, so to the best of my understanding, based on what we've heard from our lawyers, the state will present a case, has presented some arguments on why this lawsuit should be dismissed. And so our legal partners at Food and Water Watch Justice and Public Justice Food Project, and also Roxanne Conlin's in Channing Dutton's law offices, are going to show why our case has merit and why we have standing and why it should be allowed to continue to proceed.
Has there been any other similar cases in other states nearby?
At the public trust doctrine has been used in previous lawsuits. As for like specific states nearby, that would be something that I wouldn't know.
Okay. And if people want to find out more information, is there a website, or if people want to get involved with ICCI?
Oh, absolutely. The best way to get involved is probably to call us at our office and ask for someone on our farm and environment team. And our phone number is 515-282-0484.
515-282-0484.
That's right.
All so, right. Ava, are you optimistic about this lawsuit? Do you think that, I'm curious, do you know on what grounds the Attorney General is dismissing it?
Sure. So a couple of the things that they said when they wanted to dismiss the case was that we don't have standing, and that this is something that we should be taking up with the legislator and not with the courts. In response to that, you know, we do have very strong standing. You know, people are not able to use the water in the section of the Raccoon River like they should be able to. And then also we've tried to work with the legislature to get clean water legislation passed, but they've continued to block it, and we've made no progress. So this is our next step in response to that. So they're saying that we should be doing it with the legislature, and we're saying we've already tried that, and they aren't responding.
So you're saying this is kind of like a last resort effort to address the issue?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I
this,
get that.
This is something that could have totally been avoided if we could have gotten something done within the legislative session, but because of the lack of willingness to work with everyday people, we had to file the lawsuit.
Well, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Give us again your website before you leave.
IOSCCI.org.
And if people want to show up at the hearing, it's June 19th at the Polk County Courthouse, 8:30.
That's right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ava. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And you have been listening to Local Talk and this wet and rainy spring day. Thank you for joining us today. We've been your hosts, Ursula Rudenberg and Gina McAndrews. Local Talk does air at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. today, and you'll also be able to hear a recording of this show on KHOI's website, which is khoifm.org, with links to the guests and the information you heard during the program. KHOI does stream live at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Chelly. Other music you heard during today's show was Good Rain by Trevor Hall and Skunk River Song by Lindsay Nissen.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we will train you. Just come and join the Local Talk team. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for your support and thank you for listening. And we'll see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is provided in part by Northminster Presbyterian Church, presenting the 2019 Vacation Bible School, Marketplace 29 AD, an opportunity for experiential learning. Children from preschool to sixth grade are invited to visit and interact with a recreated marketplace from biblical times, June 16th to the 20th, from 6 o'clock to 8 p.m. Information and registration forms are found at www.aimsnpc.org.